Hello, it's Friday. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. A little bit later on in the show, we've got a brand new theater of the mind with one of the weirdest black-eyed kid encounters and aftermath stories I've ever heard. You guys get to hear it for the first time here, so stay tuned. That's coming up a little bit later in the show. And again, back next week, we've got a great lineup of guests and true crime coming up. We're going to be talking with Steph Young next week about the Smiley Face Killers. We've got I Knew a Murderer stories. So if you're not familiar with that, if you've known a murderer, you've been friends, related to, or something along the lines, have known a murderer, share the story with us. Don't just send me, yeah, I knew a murderer, and send me a link to an article. I want to know about the story. Doesn't have to be long. Give me a couple paragraphs about it. Give me a full page about it. But it's something we want to share on the show. Fascinating aspect of this. And we'll be doing that on our True Crime Tuesday shows once in a while. But that'll be on next True Crime Tuesday when we have Steph Young back talking about the Smiley Face Killers. Then we've got a whole week of great paranormal coming your way. I'm off to England at the end of next week. I'll be gone for a week, but I've got a whole bunch of brand new shows in the can ready for you, so you'll be able to keep tuning into the best in paranormal talk radio. We won't have any reruns between now and the beginning of the new year, God willing, and no technical difficulties. So that's what's going on with the show. I do want to get going with the show tonight because we've got a really good one. This is a guest I'm always pleased to have join us on the show, and he's always a treat to see at conferences and conventions across the United States when I get a chance to go out. Tim Shaw is joining us tonight. He is a paranormal investigator, researcher, author, and survivor, and he's been featured on many different paranormal TV series. He's here tonight. We're going to talk about a myriad of different topics, but it's always great to visit with you. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Tim.
You know what, Dave? This is a super honor to be here because, you know what, you're one of those guys that whenever I see you, we have a good time. But, you know, a lot of people may think that, you know, you're this crazy wild man, but you've got like this heart of gold, and it's really so cool to be able to go and see both sides of the real Dave Schrader. So thank you again for having me on, man. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, it's always a pleasure to have you back with us. And you're doing so many different talks and things, and I wanted to kind of combine and just chat about your experiences and some of these topics that you cover. And tonight I want to talk about seances and haunted items, because those are things that always seem to fascinate our listeners. And I really am trying to grasp and understand seances better, Tim. And I want to kind of get a little bit of background from you. Do you lead seances? I know you're a sensitive as well and do medium readings, but do you lead seances?
I do. And I'm also an instructor, Dave. I learned seance, back in the 70s when I was a kid. We used to go to Lyceum in the Lilydale Spiritualist Assembly. And one of the things that we did learn was seance. And we did something called a children's seance way back then, before most of your listeners were probably born. But what it was done in the light. And the reason why we were taught that as kids was that when physical phenomena happens, we're not shocked. We're not like blown away. So many people out there during seances, they get touched or they see something moving or whatever, and they freak. And the minute you freak, it breaks that connection. And you might as well just stop the seance right at that point. So we're taught really early on to accept physical phenomena, because seance is twofold. It is for direct, hardcore, two-way communication with the other side, and also for, you know, bringing forth physical phenomena, Dave.
Well, let me talk to you a little bit about that. I mean, the idea of a seance, you know, most of what most of us out in the world know it as, we've seen only in movies and on TV. You've got a circle of people holding hands, usually some bereaved person trying to contact their loved one to get a message from the great beyond, or you know, find the missing safety deposit key. And we know about the charlatans and Houdini's quest to beat these mediums and show that these seances are fakes. What is it like to be at a real seance? And when you're setting this up, just walk me through it. How do people sit in a circle? Do they hold hands? Do they have candles? What exactly do you do when you run your seance?
First off, let me just tell everybody out there, if you walk into a seance room, let's say anywhere they're going to hold a seance, and it's in total darkness, walk out, because you've got to go and you've got to make sure that there's no trickery, no fraud whatsoever. And the only way that you can do that is if you have some illumination. We call them red light seances, and we use either like the old dark room red lights, or we use green lights or blue lights, something subdued. But the idea is you want to make sure that everybody can see everybody else. A lot of people say, oh, well, you know, this phenomena will not happen in any kind of light, and that's bull. Because I can tell you right now, as a kid, I saw stuff, and it was in like 10:30 in the morning during Lyceum. So that's the first thing. Now, I was taught more of I guess the old style, the old ways. It's a little different now. For every different person, there's a variation of seance. But what we do primarily, what I do, is we sit down and we will say a prayer. It's more of in a religious vein, I guess, because I'm a spiritualist. And I believe that what we want to do is raise this vibration. We want to raise our vibrations high enough for the spirit world to lower their vibrations, to slow it down so we can meet sort of in the middle someplace. Everything is vibratory in nature, and that's the way physics teaches us, and that's the way the spiritualist religion has taught me. So what we do is we sit there and we will sing a song. Usually if like I'm doing something in gallery, I make everybody sing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, because everybody knows that one, then everybody laughs. But in a situation like this, in a true seance, I have them sing a couple of the old spiritual hymns just to get everybody into that mood, to kind of raise it up. I make sure that the sitters are usually boy, girl, just to have balance in the room. Sometimes that's not always, you're not always able to do it. Other mediums will say that's not important. To me, I thought we feel balance is very, very paramount. The next thing I do is I introduce myself. And the reason why you introduce yourself is so that your voice vibration can mesh with the spiritual side. And also, you know, when we start talking about those that have passed, let's face it, we're talking about the essence of someone's personality, not their personality, not their actual person, but the essence. So if we're working with an intelligent essence on the other side, you want to be as friendly as possible. You want to be able to go and let them know who you are. And then from there, we go and let everybody kind of work, you know, say who they are around the table. Now, the shape of the table doesn't mean anything. And most seances, and I'm going to be totally honest with you, most seances, we don't even use tables. We kind of sit in a circle with chairs. And that's the way we work it. Now, if you do use a table, I mean, then you can put your tools on top of it, like the seance trumpet, which looks like a big old funnel. And sometimes you'll see those levitate. Sometimes you'll hear something inside. Sometimes you'll hear voices. It all depends on the mixture of the people that are there. Bells, that's the old ways. Tambourines, but you leave everything on the table so that it can be observed. Now, the old chalkboards, like we used to use in school, maybe not you, Dave, but I used to use them in school.
Yes, I was still of that generation, Tim.
I know. I was trying to be kind, but you know, we use those, but what we do is we make sure that we take two slates and we slide them into a little black velvet bag, but we set that on the table. When I was a kid, they used to put it underneath the medium's chair, but we set that on the table. Beforehand, we go and we make sure that whoever's leading the seance, they usually call that the ringmaster or you know, the leader, only they will speak unless the spirit coming through directly wants them to talk, and we can talk about how you know later. But there's also somebody else that's very important there, and we call that person the battery. The battery is where everybody will focus their intent and their energy on one person. That is what powers a lot of the seance itself, the battery. People don't realize that. People think that you're just sitting there going, oh, on the other side, I want to go and talk to Marilyn Monroe or something. And that's not the way it works. We go and we focus our energy into one person. Now, how can I describe the atmosphere? The atmosphere in these rooms, it's like the barometric pressure starts to get heavy. That's the best way I can describe it. Those of you out there who have been in like negative situations and hauntings, or whenever something is starting to really amp up, you're starting to feel that uneasy barometric pressure. Well, it's the same way. It will go and it will start to dip. It will start to dip and you start feeling that. So when you start feeling that, then you know something is starting to go on. And whoever's leading the seance will now go and say, listen, this is what we're here for. It can be anything for direct communication with one person who has passed, or it could be as general as we need a sign, we need messages. We're here for the production of ectoplasm. We're here to witness physical phenomena. And what you do is everybody around the table is already on the same page. It's very important because it has to be of like mind. You sit there and you try to go and you work with it and try to work with spirit as best you can. You open yourself up as best you can. And
so are you working this as a channeling device where the beings speak through you, or are you trying to make direct communication where there's rappings, voices, messages left on the chalkboard? How does that work?
Again, it's all of what everybody wants it to be. People don't realize that. People don't think that they have a choice. Everybody sits down and says, listen, we want to hear something. We want rapping. Spirit, talk to us. Give me two raps for yes, you know, and you know, sometimes you'll get that. Sometimes it'll affect the lights that are actually in the room. We've had lights actually just the power just drain right out of it, you know, and they start getting darker and dimmer and they come back on. It's all part of it. You can use it as a channel device. You can also use it as methodology for direct contact. And that's pretty much what most people want, is that direct contact. There's so many different ways. For every different seance, there is different, it produces different manifestations. And that's what you want. And again, you work with it. If nothing happens, and the best thing I have to tell you, probably the most important thing I have to tell you is, nothing or something doesn't happen every time. The best seances are those that have the exact same people who sit at the exact same time, week after week, the same day, same time, and continue it. When I was working at a spiritual, when I was serving the pulpit at a spiritualist temple locally in Western New York, we had a group that started off with 16 people, and people started to freak when things were starting to happen in this church. It kind of pared down to six, and the six of us were all of the same mind, we were all on the same page, and we were all excited about this, and we started to get the feel of cotton candy that would come over us. We would get the sound of the, you know, footsteps and different things, different manifestations that were happening. So it takes time. You have to attune yourself. It's almost like the same thing with the tools of seance. You have to attune yourself. If you're a paranormal investigator, you'll know this for a fact. The more that you work with, let's say, your recorder, the more successful you're going to be. So that's
right. It's like you become connected with that tool.
Right. Exactly, Dave.
Right.
Exactly. You know, and that's what you want to do. That's exactly what you want to do. And of course, if it does, nothing happens in 20 minutes, well, then you stop it. But if you're working with a table, I'll tell you what, I've never sat in seance that the table didn't move, and that's called table turning or table tipping, where the table will actually have a vibratory feel that comes up through the table, and it will actually, you can get it to wrap out alphabets, to make them into words, like almost like a Ouija board. You can get it to spin. There's a lot of different things. We've had it so that the table, we had a very, very heavy table at the church. Actually, all four legs come right off the ground with six of us on the table, just with our hands on it. So it's the manifestation of physical phenomena. When things start to slow down, let's say you've already had your phenomena, or, you know, somebody has gone into trance and has brought through messages, and it slows down. The barometric pressure starts to change again. You can feel it. That's a sign that it's going to end. You slowly stop. You have everybody take their hands off. Let's see, if you got a table, you take them off the table, or you just put your hands, instead of having your hands down on your knees, just turn them over so that it kind of breaks the connection, and you say a thank you. Everybody around the circle will thank the spirits that have worked with us, and they will go, and we sit down, and then afterwards we discuss it. But it's important that you thank it, because it's a process, because we're opening up what a lot of people would call a portal. We are going and opening up this channel for the other side to come in and touch in with us. Likewise, we want this to leave. We want these essences to leave. You don't want an attachment. Sometimes attachments get kind of lost. So you want to give enough time. You say, thank you, we're going to close the session now, and I'm going to count from 10 down to 1. I ask everybody to come back. I respectfully thank you. And then at the end, I usually have a prayer. And that's what it is. And I have to say that in all the years that I've done this, and it's been quite a few years, Dave, I've never had a negative, anything negative happen. And I think that I'm very, very blessed, but I'm also very, very cautious. I'm very anal about going through the etiquette and very, very anal about opening and closing these sessions, because you know enough that people that just fool around with the boards and that what damage they can do.
Right, but you see, I'm one of those that I also believe it has nothing to do with the tools itself, and that it has more to do with why you're doing what you're doing. And if you're doing it for fun and a lark and trying to scare somebody, which I found with most issues with, like, Ouija boards, most people played with them at a party. Most of the times, the guys will admit they were trying to get their girlfriend a little scared so they'd snuggle up a little bit closer, or any of those deals. So I think that sometimes when we have the creepier things happen, it's because that's the intent that we put forward.
Exactly, Dave. Exactly. People don't realize that. I first started working with Ouija boards when I was probably 11 years old. And now I can hear some of your listeners just go, oh my God, he's cursed. We learned not so much on a board, but a polished surface. We took a shot glass for yes or no answers. The next thing that we did, a woman who taught some of the classes, I always remember a lovely woman by the name of Gladys, she went and she was from England. And she had one of the original writing planchets, which is a pencil, and it was a larger, looked like a Ouija board planchet, but the pencil was stuck through it and had two wheels in the back. And you would put your hands on it, and it would move around on a sheet of paper, and it would draw, and it would write messages and stuff. And, I mean, I guess, to me, it was all very, very normal, very, very calming to me. To know that those on the other side were sort of with me. And I had I still have a very, very healthy respect for things that may happen, because we all have heard about the horror stories. And again, you've talked about it time and time again, the Zozo phenomena or the kids that, the Ouija board said to them for one kid to kill the other kid. If you start reading about it in research papers, you start seeing how people lost fortunes because the Ouija board told them to do it. It's the same thing as seance or anything else that we do. We all have common sense and free will. If your common sense says there's something wrong here, your free will should kick in and say, I've had enough. We stop it. Now, that's not because of fear. I call it respect, because you're respecting those on the other side. You're respecting the device, you're respecting the tradition. And doing it this way, Dave, you never have a problem. I don't know how many times, I just got a message on Facebook where somebody had been working with, I'm not sure what kind of a tool of divination, but now they have something that's following them and they need help. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why did you play with this thing in the first place? And I know that it's curiosity, and I know that people are people. And they want to know. But before you jump in, I mean, I'll be honest with you, before I jump in the deep end of the pool, I'm going to make sure that I have my water wings on and I've practiced in the shallow end, man. You know
exactly. Exactly. And there are a lot of horror stories out there from not knowing what you're doing, which brings up my next point, Tim Shaw. Now, I want to tell you, too, Tim, as we're talking about the way and intent that you do and in these different ways to communicate. You know, I know that there are a lot of people that want to have an experience, but they're afraid to ask mediums. Because here's the deal. It can be intimidating. If you're really getting information, a lot of people are worried that they're going to give you information that maybe, you know, they don't want you to know, right? They're worried
that the
ghosts may come forward. And I think that's why people rely on divination tools and try to make the communication. So maybe they get the message and it's least embarrassing for them. But, you know, if you're going into these things in fear or with trepidation, I think you're going to find that that's when you have the most trouble and struggles. When you have these seances, and as you said, everybody's kind of got to be of the like mind, but I'm sure you get some skeptical people in there. Do the skeptics, when they're part of your seance groups, if they're truly kind of trying to be open to this, does the experience actually come to fruition, or do you find that when they're there, nothing happens?
I've never had a problem with a skeptic yet. Never. So long as they have an open mind. The idea is that they can't be negative. You know, there's a lot of skeptics out there that are just, you know, this is BS. This is nothing. This is garbage. They're angry about it. They want to make a point. But there's a lot of skeptics out there, a lot of agnostics out there who are like, listen, you know what? I don't really kind of believe this stuff, but I'm going to try and I'm going to have an open mind. I'm going to be open to this. If something happens, but you got to prove it to me. And I'll be honest with you, sometimes it works and it works pretty well. We had a guy about 8 years ago that was just like that. And we started getting the wraps on the wall, and it was a really unique situation because the wraps didn't just come on one wall. They were like in the ceiling and the floor and all over the place. And true spiritual wraps have a metallic tinge to them. It sounds like somebody's hitting metal against like concrete. I guess that's the best way to describe it. And I looked at him and I said, I just have the feeling that spirit wants me to ask you, if you have a question, a yes or no question, let's just work with that, that perhaps you would like to ask the test. And he said, yeah. He says, is my mother in heaven? Well, one rap was yes, two raps were no. Bang, bang, two raps come through. And everybody kind of looked at each other like, what? Because like spiritualists, we don't really believe in heaven or hell. You know, it's sort of like a neutral ground there that we kind of rest for a while after we pass. And he looked at me and he says, well, that's because my mom's still living. So, you know, it's a 50-50 thing, but it came through at that time. And he kind of sat there and I said, just ask a couple more questions. And the yes or no answers did fulfill what he was asking. And while he still isn't a true convert where like everything is paranormal, everything is supernatural or whatever, he has more of a healthy respect, I believe, for the people that do this work and for, you know, the different religions that kind of work within it.
Yeah, I've been fascinated about attending seances, and it's something I've wanted to do. I've been in a couple of settings where it's been seance-like, but it's been more of a mediumship gallery or reading where everybody's right, just kind of in a powwow circle kind of sense as opposed to being a true seance. And I guess I think a lot of us have a bad taste in our mouth because it's been always so portrayed as hokey and fake.
Absolutely.
Do you even have these experiences when you're doing them and you're hosting them that something's going on and you just feel like this just feels like carnival maneuvers to me?
Let me tell you something. I grew up at the very end of the Golden Age. And the Golden Age is where there was a lot of really great stuff. I mean, I grew up with mediums that would stand there during the church services and they'd be speaking out their mouths and then out of their solar plexus, another voice would be talking. And, you know, I don't know how or why, but it was an amazing thing. I saw a lot of amazing things, but I saw a lot of 2-bit carny tricks. And to me, I call that the golden age of fraud, where people were just trying to dupe people. And it kind of just, I don't know, it tarnished a lot of it for me. So, and that's why a lot of the churches for years and years and years would not let anybody, would not really let anybody do a lot of physical phenomena work or even seance work, because they felt that we became targets. People would be too apt to cheat. And I've been at seances where I've sat there and I thought to myself, you gotta be kidding me. This is BS. I mean, where, you know, the table would start to rock. And I'd have my hands, I'd just have my fingers on the table very lightly. And I'd look over, and again, we're doing it with some kind of light going on, you know, like a red or, like I say, the green or blue light. And I could see the medium who was leading the seance, his fingertips turning white. So the next time we would come in, I would say, listen, guys, let's try this a little differently. If you have anybody out there that's read the or heard of the Philip experiment, Conjuring Philip up in right. Canada in 1972, what they did sometimes is they took doilies and put them underneath the hands of the sitters, the participants, and put it on the table. In certain times, it would work. The table would move and levitate. Other times, it wouldn't. With this particular gentleman, the next time I came in, I put the doily underneath his hands. He was not happy, and nothing happened. I could see him pressing down. So, you know, there is this overwhelming feeling that, yeah, you know, I want to go and impress these people. And even for the right reasons is wrong. People want to impress people to go and say, you know, I just want to bring people into the fold and show them that this stuff is possible. And to me, that's wrong. That's not truth. We all should be truth seekers out there. We should be out there trying to find out the truth, whether we don't succeed or we succeed. And that's something that really kind of, you know, I don't understand. Like people, like even in the paranormal world, that fake EVPs or fake this or that. Why are you doing that? Is your life that sad that you need this acclamation from other people because you are cheating or you're fraudulent? It's the same thing within the religions. So I would rather go and have nothing happen than, you know, cheat, because nothing happening is also the truth too. So to me, that's very important. And when I was a little kid, I mean, we used to sit at the foot of these stairs at the Maplewood Hotel in Lilydale, and we weren't allowed to sit Friday, Saturday nights. We were not allowed to sit on the steps or the porch or anything, because all the old time mediums, the visiting ones and the residents, they would sit up there and they would rock. And at that time, they could smoke their cigars and pipes up there, and they would just talk about all this great stuff. And I think that's where I got my best education. And I remember them saying that it was far better to be ethical, because spirit will take care of you in the end. Spirit will go and eventually help you find your and achieve your goal, than to go and to lie. Because if you lie, what are you doing? You're just bringing more trouble onto yourself. Spirit, you know, everything's vibrational in nature. And you want to be honest. You want to work in a true form with those on the other side. At least I do. And to me, here's the other thing, Dave, that people don't realize. Mm-hmm. Messages and all this other stuff, they're not the mediums. They're the person who is you're talking to, whoever you're bringing this through to, whether it's in seance, whether it's personal gallery. People often ask me, well, Tim, you said this in gallery. Can you elaborate? And I look at him and I say, no, because I trained myself not to remember any of them, because it's not mine. I don't care. I'm going to go when spirit comes through. I'm going to go and I'm going to tell you something, whether you like to hear it, whether you don't want to hear it, whether you can understand it, whether you don't understand it. I don't care, because it's not me. It's the message coming through. So people don't realize that as mediums, I don't want that acclamation. I've been blessed, Dave. You know what? You know yourself, and I always say it. I've been blessed. I get a chance to hang with you a couple times a year. Every so often I go and do some of these cons. But I've been blessed because of the fact that I've never gone and pandered to an audience. I mean, I'm a ham, and you know that. I mean, I like to laugh, and I like to go and have a good time. But I don't pander to the audience. I don't pander to a congregation. I don't pander to anybody, because when I'm doing the work of spirit, I'm not doing the work of Tim Shaw. I have no agenda. The person that's in front of me at that time is the most important person in my life, and I'm going to go and I'm going to try to be the clearest channel I can. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm not going to go and say, Dave, come to my seance, and then all this phenomena happens, and then you find out that I was a fraud. I don't want that. I mean, I don't want that. You know, I don't want that because I don't really care about the fame or the popularity. I mean, if this whole thing ended tomorrow, I'm very, very blessed, and I'm very thankful for what I've done and the people that I've met through this amazing journey that I've been on. But people don't get that. People sometimes, you know, whether they want to or subconsciously or consciously, they need that. They think that by faking it, they're going to go somewhere. And it's not a foot race, man. It's what I do is spirit takes me on the journey, and I don't care where it takes me. I just don't care. And when people realize that I don't care, then everything, and I start attracting more honest, more ethical people around me. So,
you know that brings up a point, and we both know a lot of people in the field, and I think that sometimes it not necessarily ethics in the way people think of it, Tim. Truthfully, I think that sometimes people have a skill, they get really good at it, and then when activity stops being so prevalent around them, they feel pressure to
produce
and still make people happy. And I think that's what, you know, you've got great mediums like Derek Acora, who I believe is a very talented man, but he's forced to do certain things for TV. And he was, you know, you can't always just do a circus act. And I've talked to people that are behind the scenes of that show, and basically he was told, you know, we'll screw with your career. You have to produce a ghost here. We need to hear about this, or we need to hear about that. And then when they got tired of him, they tried to discredit him.
Exactly.
So it's a shame. So I think there are people like that. And in the paranormal field, I don't feel shame or pity for them. I wish that they weren't in that position. But, you know, sometimes, and I understand it too, you know, you enjoy the accolades. Even though you say, you know, I'm not in it for that, it's still nice to have people appreciate and respect you. And that may be the only thing that they get is when they're out getting that kind of response. So I do understand. It's just a shame because it can cast a black eye on the entire field when it is eventually broken.
Here's something that somebody, again, told me as a kid. And again, I was sitting there one time, and I always remember this guy, and he had this big old walrus mustache, and he was smoking a pipe. And I was sitting there looking up and listening, and he looked at me and he said, boy, he says, what you're learning here is to be an addition to your life. This is not to be your life, meaning being a reader is not to be your life. Get out there, get a job, get a family, work, have a true, real life. And what you're learning, this spirituality, this ability, because I'm not going to call it a gift. I mean, anybody can do it if they put the intent and work into it. This ability is to be an unbelievable addition to your life. And again, I've been blessed, man. I just retired this year after 34 and a half years of pushing asphalt and concrete and plowing snow here in Western New York. And I don't need it. I don't need it for the money. I don't need it for anything else. It's nice to have people like you. I agree with you there. But here's the bottom line. If they don't, I'm sure that there's probably an equal amount of people that say he's full of S, you know, BS or whatever. It's all good because it's not mine. I'm just a tool of spirit, and that's the way I look at things. And again, my blessings are monumental. But by taking that out of the equation,
right,
by not worrying about money, not buying, you know, I mean, you know as well as I do. I've done the pilots where they turn around and say, well, Tim, you have to say this, and I wouldn't do it. And what did they do? They took a scene that we shot 3 weeks before and fit it in. I didn't say it, and I wouldn't say it, because this is the way I always feel. Everybody else is not in the same situation I am, because my faith in spirituality, if it's threatened, I would turn off everything else I did. I would never do another event, and I would only serve the churches. These people, I remember talking to the president of a production company, a rather large one right now that has been absorbed into A&E, and I said to him, I said, this guy is an actor. He's your ringer. We find out something's fraudulent. Guess what happens? He just gets another gig. This other guy goes back to whatever he does, you know, back home. Me, because of the position I'm in, I get blackballed. And for me to serve a church or to do a service somewhere is probably the highest thing that I've ever done. I mean, weddings and naming ceremonies, I would do that rather than be on TV or be on the radio or anything of that matter, because it means more to me than that. So a lot of people, you know, and Derek Acora, I remember interviewing him. I love that guy. And I, you know, I followed his career, the highs and lows. And that's exactly what it is. People don't understand that the almighty dollar and entertainment, of course, kind of go hand in hand. And you have to produce. It's the same thing as the Fox sisters and all the early mediums. These people, you know, many of them had absolute fantastic ability. But you can't produce every time. You can't produce. I have off days. I can't. You know what? People come up to me and say, oh, my God, you said this and that and this. It's really great, and this came through. Hey, that's all cool. Thank you for the validation. I appreciate it. But there are days out there that, you know what? I couldn't read a bag of celery, you know, because it just doesn't work. And sometimes your vibrations are different than the person that comes up to you. My rule of thumb is, and I don't do psychic fairs very often. I do it for a friend or whatever. I'll, you know, to help them out, or I do it for charity. Mostly I'm actually trained to serve the pulpit, which is a gallery reader. And somebody comes up to me and I don't feel that I'm giving them a good reading and I don't feel like there's a good connection. Here, take your money back.
Right.
Take it.
Let me ask you about that, because you do have a religious background as well with the sensitivity. And here's something I've been curious more about. What do you think, Tim Shaw, the odds are that these spirits that come through to tell us messages and connect us with our loved ones are just the angelic realm filling a position, taking on the role to help ease and aid our grieving, as opposed to mom or dad's ghost coming back through the ether of heaven to do this? You know, if it really is that they are in training or reprogramming or whatever you want to refer to it as, couldn't it be more possible that this really isn't our loved ones, but it's somebody representing them passing these messages on?
Let me push it one step further. Are these intelligent personalities, whether they're, and again, I'm going to use the angelic realm for higher vibrational beings, because that's what we would call them.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen? Do you think it's possible that perhaps, you know, Dave, you come to me and you say, listen, you know, who's around me? And I pick up X, Y, and Z. What are the chances that perhaps I'm just reading your subconscious mind? What are the chances that perhaps there is nothing on the other side? There are no beings on the other side. I'm just picking up on what's around you. Or what are the chances, and I bring this up a lot.
And I believe what you just said, because I've often wondered if we do carry these memories. And listen, we know, because it happens in the animal kingdom, that we can carry coded genomic memory from our ancestors. So maybe, and because I know the initial answer is, because you're telling me things I don't know, I have to go back and validate through my mom or grandmother. Well, if I'm carrying a piece of them because they're part of my DNA, why wouldn't it all be stored in our family or ancestry card catalogs?
Absolutely. This is something that got me in trouble with the churches, which I left a large organization to become an independent, someone who serves the pulpit, serves churches independently, because I questioned that. I question that, and that's the point that I brought up. Is it? Are we living a lie? Could we be living a lie? Is it possible? Well, they didn't like that. I mean, that's something that you know. Of course, we're talking about organizations, and we all know that spirituality is a covenant between yourself and God, or your God, or your deity, or whatever. But religions are organizations created by man, usually to serve the deity, to whatever. But every so often they get a little cranky, they get duct tape on their butts, and they get very, very narrow-minded. And you have to go and you have to question. A true person on a journey, no matter what, questions everything. I question everything. And people always say, well, Tim, you know, you bring these things through, you see this stuff, you have had these experiences. Yes, Am I creating myself? Is somebody else creating? Am I in the right place at the right time? Is this what's happening? Have I trained myself to open up a sense that is primal in us? I don't know. But the idea is to question it. You don't have to believe everything you question, but you have to question it. And people don't understand that. People say, see, the problem is we're so used to absolutes. We're so used to being pablum fed and having those absolutes put into our lap. And I don't believe in that. I believe that the journey is the most wonderful thing that we've ever done. I mean, you know my medical problems that I've had, and I'm looking at probably surgery number 10 coming up. Was it caused by X, Y, and Z? Is it a miraculous thing? Is it something that is genetic? Whatever. It's part of the journey, and everything in the journey is a lesson, and it'll be a lesson, and it's something that I find exciting, because these questions that I have sustain me through the dark times, and we all have those dark nights of the soul where we question everything, and or we have that depression, or during those really terrible times. But that's what sustains me, because I get a chance to sit there and I think abstract in those ways, and I find a bizarre peace in questioning what I do. And again, I try to go and I tell my, when I was teaching, I try to tell my students that. I try to tell some of the church elders, some of the board members, some of the, I'll go down to the Lilydale Assembly and we'll sit in the Mediums League, which is a beautiful little octangular house, and we'll have these discussions. And, they look at me as if I have like three eyes and four ears, because these are things that nobody ever questions. And when you bring that up, sometimes you push the envelope, sometimes people get upset by it. But the bottom line is, it's a possibility. It's within the realm of possibility. If we start going back to the hunter-gatherer stage, we needed this sense in order to survive. It was only until we started living behind walls and becoming agricultural that we started to lose that. And only the priests and the hierarchy and the shamans and those sort of people actually kept it alive. And then all of a sudden, some people, they're born with this ability, and it's natural. And then the rest of us have to learn, to do this stuff. So again, what is it? Do we know it? Is it part of that instinctual thing? Is it in our DNA? I don't know. And to me, that's exciting. But along the way, sometimes you try to bring solace to people who are grieving. And the bottom line of the spiritual religion of which, and my philosophy that I follow, is to be of service to those who are living and those who have passed. I can be a clown, and a lot of times I try to go and bring laughter and joy to, people that, when we're out there, we're all together, at these cons and stuff. But the bottom line is that that's my job. That is something that I feel very, 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 I guess, that's the reason why I'm here. That's the reason why I do this. And if I can help one person in my entire life, then my life was well worth it. It was well spent. And along that way, think about things. Think about all the abstracts. Think about why, how, when, and what the hell are we doing here? These are all great things to ponder. And so long as you're of aid, then I think that your job and your life is well spent.
I couldn't agree more. Our guest this evening is the one and only Tim Shaw. Let me make a quick mention to you folks. We have something really cool going on. If you go to podcastone.com, click on the Killer Deals link, then find Beyond the Darkness banner, our little ghost with the microphone. Click on that and you'll see our advertisers there. But we've got a special deal. If you go in through the Amazon banner, you're going to see all kinds of really cool items that Tim and I have hand selected for our store. Ghost hunting tools, DVDs, some of our favorite. As a matter of fact, we have some great points in there right now. The entire Twilight Zone series, the entire Night Gallery TV series, the entire In Search of DVD series. How about Kolchak the Night Stalker, the entire original series on DVD. You've got books in there from many of the authors that you've heard on our show and so much more. So go check it out by going to Killer Deals on the Killer Deals on the podcast1.com website and click on the Beyond the Darkness banner. We're going to have that set up on our page as well, so you can go in and click the Killer Deals link. It'll take you into the Amazon page, and you can order from there. And every time you place an order through that program, it's an affiliate program, a very small percentage of those sales goes a long way to help your buddies Dave and Tim. And we're going to be adding more items every week to that shop, so you can continually look for some of the coolest and best items that you want to purchase that have the supernatural, paranormal, and true crime taste. So that's going to take place. And Amazon.com brings us our next segment, because it's time to go into the bowels of hell as we visit with the Darkhives in this, another edition of Theater of the Mind.
Once Bitten, a real-life confrontation with black-eyed kids, as told by Kathy Kay. I once had a black-eyed kid experience, and to this day I'm living with the effects. When I started college in 1999, I used to babysit for book and tuition money and had a family that I would regularly babysit for. The father was very kind and protective, but had recently been even more so. It would become obvious why later. They lived in a cute little house about 15 minutes away from my home in Quebec. They had a farmer's field and woods surrounding their property. On this particular night in October, I was preparing the kids for bed. We heard a knock at the door. The young boy was 7 or 8 at the time and was very helpful and sweet. He just offered to go get the door. I knew his dad would be mad if I let him answer the door, so I called him back and went to get the door myself. Here's where things got weird. They had 4 cute cats that would follow the kids and I around all the time. I had not yet noticed they were nowhere in sight. As I got to the door, one of the cats came bolting down the hall and started pawing at me and meowing loudly at me. I thought it was weird behavior. I looked up and couldn't see the others, just the kids in the living room. As I reached for the door handle, the cat took off as if I had sprayed him with water. I opened the door about halfway and saw 2 kids, a boy and a girl, both dressed very old-fashioned. They looked like they were from the 60s and had straight black hair. They said in unison, "Can we come in?" They never really looked up at me. They just looked forward. Now, I thought it sounded rehearsed, but creepy. I thought to myself, no way. This has to be a prank. What was this, Children of the Corn? Nobody talks in unison like that. I told them that it was too late. The kids are going to bed now. Come back another day. Just then they yelled, "No! This is our only chance. Again, in unison. Then they calmed down and said, We won't be here tomorrow. I still remember the smell. As I stood there with the door partly open, it smelled like they had been sitting in rotten food. Imagine if you burned some stew and then let it get cold and rot. But it wasn't overpowering, just a hint of nasty smell. I know that I probably should have shrieked, but I calmly said, "I'm sorry, but it's too late tonight," with my eyes open so wide. You could probably see my lashes touching my eyebrows. I suddenly felt sick and panicked. I reached for the door handle with both my right and left hand, with my right arm across my body, and the girl bit my arm hard. I slammed the door and yelled some things that those kids I was babysitting probably shouldn't have heard. I started to cry as it was bleeding and pounding. I was both mad and scared. I flipped on the lights and ran to the living room window. I grabbed a hockey stick on my way past the closet and looked out the window. There was no one there. No one in the yard. No one in the driveway. They could not have gone the other direction because of the chicken fence they put up for their dog. The family had lost their dog just a few months ago and still had a 5-foot-tall chicken fence with steel fence poles. I imagined to calm everything down and get the kids to sleep. I told them that kids like the ones at the door are jerks and not to be friends with kids who act like that. That night I didn't study. I didn't sleep. When the parents got hold, I told them what happened, and the father asked me if I got a good look at him. I told him I did, and he asked me about their eyes. I nearly peed myself when I realized I only ever saw black. No white at all. It had never struck me. He asked me if they were blue, green, brown, or black. When I answered black, the mother started crying. The father gently hugged me from the side and said he would take me home after I got my bite looked at. I talked a bit to the father, and he told me that the same kids with black eyes had scared his wife. He had put a baseball bat in the coat closet next to where I found the hockey stick. I wasn't sure if it was a good thing or a bad thing that I hadn't found the bat when the evil buggers were still at the door. We spent the better part of the night in the ER waiting. When they finally took the cloth off my arm, it wasn't bleeding anymore, and it had scabbed up okay. The doctor asked how many days it had been. I said only 4 or 5 hours. He said it looks like it's healing fast. They gave me a tetanus shot and a rabies shot and shoveled me out the door, like hospitals here in Quebec do. Now this part gets even weirder. The next day I was feeling a bit sick and my breasts hurt. I was starving and ignored the light nausea and decided to eat breakfast, then brunch, then lunch, then a large snack, then supper, and finally a second supper. Now I'm about 5'4 and 130 pounds. I'm not a big eater, but I was starving. Over the next week, it was the same every day. I was so hungry. A bit of nausea, sore breasts. I had no boyfriend at the time and was not seeing anyone. So I looked up the symptoms online like any mid-20s girl. Now this was 1999 or 2000, so it took a while to find the info. No WebMD or Google to answer my questions. Everything pointed to pregnancy. I knew that was impossible, but decided to confirm it. I took 6 pregnancy tests over the next 4 days. All positive. I was about 2 weeks late, so now I'm panicked. What happened? I didn't do anything. As I sat on my couch and put my hands to my forehead, I noticed the pale scar on my right forearm. I didn't end up with pinkish teeth marks, but white marks. Kind of like when you get a tan, but some skin was covered and stayed pale. I went to see my doctor, and he confirmed that I was chemically testing positive. I asked for an examination because I knew it was impossible. He confirmed I did not seem pregnant. I went back every 3 weeks or so for a few months. Thank God we have Medicare here in Canada. I was not pregnant. It's been 14 years. Still test positive. Still no baby. I have considered a side business as a wet nurse, as I am up 4 cup sizes and have been since a month after the incident with those kids. The downside being backaches and an incredible appetite. The upside, I don't seem to gain much weight no matter what I eat, and none of my partners ever minded the extra size. But the sad note is, my doctor thinks that I will not be able to ever have children. I've been in relative good health. No black-eyed kid sightings either. I hear of cancer, suicide, and all sorts of terrible consequences. All I got was a scar and sterility. I've had regular checkups and no cancer of any kind. I'm sharing my story because only my parents, aunt, and one boyfriend believe me. And I would like to encourage others that have been affected by the black-eyed kids to come forward. Not everyone who sees UFOs or Bigfoot or black-eyed kids is a wacko. I'm not saying I'm playing with a full deck of cards either, but I know what I saw, what happened to me, and what happened to that poor family.
Beyond the Darkness.
Tim Shaw, our guest today on the Best in Paranormal Talk Radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Let me remind you, I am hosting Coast to Coast AM tonight, and you can find ways to listen by visiting coasttocoastam.com/stations. You can find stations all across the nation. They're on over 600 radio stations around the United States, plus XM Sirius and other ways to tune in. You can also listen to it on knsiradio.com, knsiradio.com. That's my radio home for Coast to Coast AM. That's where I broadcast from every time you hear me on the air. And tomorrow night, or tonight, I should say, I have Michael Nesmith from the Monkees. It's the 51st anniversary of the Prefab Four. We're going to talk about the Monkees and his life afterward. Fascinating man. And I'll tell you, there are some elements of his story that definitely dabble in almost the metaphysical. We're going to talk about that. And then we have open phone lines for the last 2 hours. Then Saturday night, I'm back again, and we're going to be talking true crime. We've got Amaryllis Fox and Jeff Mudgett from the TV series on History Channel, American Ripper. And then we've got another great guest who's going to join me who has a very unique perspective on serial killers. She has a new book out. She's written a few others, and she's worked side by side with serial killers. We'll find out more about that tomorrow night. And again, that's Coast to Coast AM. Each one starts at midnight till 4 a.m. Central Time. So you can find information by going to coasttocoastam.com. Tim Shaw, my guest tonight. And I know we've only got a very short time left together, but I want to talk about haunted items. Possessed Possessions, I know, is a very popular title on this stuff, Tim, but I'm so baffled by this. You know, I get the idea of a location being haunted. I get the possibilities of ghosts wandering the earth aimlessly. I could even understand in some cases with jewelry or articles of clothing that were worn often by a person that there could be resonant energy attached to it. But to believe that it may truly be haunted or that a ghost stays around after its death, stuck to an item, help me understand this, Tim Shaw.
Well, first off, not everything that they claim to be haunted is haunted.
What?
A lot of it is psychological. A lot of people have guilt associated with a lot of different things. You've got to be almost like a detective. You know, and somebody comes and says, dude, I got this crazy thing. I brought this thing into the house and we have all this stuff going on. Okay, well, where did you get it from? Did you buy it? Did you steal it? Where'd you get it from? If it's something that may have been belonging to your mother or whatever, let's talk about the psychological implications right up front. So you have to be a detective with it. But let's talk about items, how they become quote unquote truly haunted. Everything's a vibration. We all know that. Everything, the quicker it vibrates, the harder it is to ascertain, to see, to hear, to experience, to feel. But the slower it vibrates, the easier it is to experience. So if things are truly vibratory in nature, emotions, and we believe as spiritualists, thoughts are things and things are vibrations, well then times of high emotional impact can go and affect the vibratory nature of an item. Same thing with love. Let's say you have this piece that, you know, let's say a watch, and it belonged to your father and you really loved this thing and he loved it more than anything in the world. It was something very special to him. Yeah, something like that can become quote unquote haunted. But those are positive things. It's almost like my friend Jason Love from Edinburgh, Scotland. He sent me a couple pieces because he knows that I have a huge interest in it, and I do have a rather quickly growing collection. Johnny Zaffis gave me the highest compliment. He said my office is starting to look like his museum, and that scares me on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, it should.
But it was really neat that what he sent me was a cross. It was this iron cross that was in a monk's room. And when the monk passed away, and he used to venerate it every day. This is what he used to kneel before and pray. Well, this is focused intent. This is vibratory focused intent. His will, his vibrations were focused into this piece. And it's something of this nature can be positive. It's like using the relics of saints. Someone who is deathly sick, they bring the relics of a saint, let's say something that they, you know, possessed, a cross or a rosary, they place it on that person, and this person starts to become better. That's a positive haunted possession. The negative haunted possessions can be anything that, you know, how people curse things, they believe in, let's say these different deities that are good and bad. Let's say there's an effigy, a fetish, or a statue that, especially from the South, the Pacific, the Pacific area, Africa. These are lands of many gods, and they will worship these things. Here in the United States, especially in Western New York, we have something that's called the False Face Medicine Society. It is part of the Iroquois traditions, and what they are masks that are carved from living trees. And there's a big Cain and Abel story that goes with it. And they are made to go and help the person heal someone who may be afflicted through dance, through different things. And they're very, very interesting. However, they take on a supernatural quality because of the person using it. That person is using focused in. A lot of the SEALs, when they go through training, they get through training for one reason, because they use this unbelievable laser point focused intent, where that becomes the most important. That completing the task becomes the most important thing in their lives. Thus, it works the same way. You're using this effigy, you're using this piece, it becomes that laser point focused intent. You're affecting the vibratory nature of it. So something that is negative. See, I'm one of these guys that, you know, people get pissed off at me when I say this, but I believe energy is neutral. It takes either spirit or man to affect it, to make it positive or negative. And if you can go and you can affect this, you know, this energy negatively, it can affect, let's say, you know, a music box or something of that nature. And people start to see this stuff and they bring it into their houses and they start to have problems with it. I know someone that brought in a table into their house and they started getting, seeing like apparitions and hearing voices. And I said, well, where did the table come from? Well, it came from this bar, and the bar was called, believe it or not, this is the name. It's a place where you and I would actually drink, called the Bucket of Blood.
Oh, sure, out in Virginia City.
Oh, there's a couple here in Western New York. And
oh,
up in Canada.
Wow! All right.
Yeah, I've actually stumbled in and out of a couple of them, and not that I do it on a normal basis, mm-hmm, but you know, mm-hmm. For scientific research, I've done it, but. That's where it came from. It was an old biker bar, and it saw a lot of activity. So could this have affected it? Absolutely. Could it have, you know, just being in that type of atmosphere negatively affect it? Absolutely. When they took it out of the house, everything stopped. So it was the peace. A lot of people don't realize that places of high impact, emotional impact, let's say a battlefield, Gettysburg is a prime example, Dave, because people they like to take stones and stuff from places that they go to. It's like free souvenirs, and they take these stones back, and stuff starts happening in their house. Well, you know, a lot of these stones, nothing really happened. They were deposited there in the 1930s, or they were rebuilt the wall with them. But some of these stones actually were present in 1863, and it could have, and I believe that because of the vibrations, I believe that people within these, in these situations of terror and fear and hatred and anger and confusion and chaos, this can imprint on the ground and imprint into the earth. And I believe some of these stones that people actually pick up can bring this stuff back with them. And I got to tell you a mess up. You want to hear Dave about yours truly messing up?
I'll share this. Okay.
Well, because this way you have blackmail material on me. But anyway.
Bad news. Bad news. I've had that for years, Tim.
Oh, well, that takes care of that. I mean, you know, now I know I'm in trouble. But I had a gig in New Orleans this year, and I went to one of the local cemeteries. And I'm walking by, and I love New Orleans. It was my first trip. I'm really grooving in this cemetery. I mean, I'm feeling really great. And I see a debris pile, and there's a little piece of mortar. It's a little piece of mortar. You know it came out of one of the uprights, one of the upright tombs. And I looked at it, and I said, you know, that would be wonderful. I'd love to have this in my little cabinet of curiosities. I really would. This is something that I would venerate. I think this would be wonderful. And it wasn't even near a tomb. It was in a debris pile. So I took it, and I put it in my pocket and never thought anything of it. And, you know, it was one of the – and I'll tell you what happened. It was one of the most hellacious airplane rides back home after the gig. Oppressive nature started going on in the house, my wife and I. And we don't really fight that often. I mean, you know, we're just like anybody else. And we're fighting a lot. Things are going wrong. My car had problems, a lot of things. I end up stubbing my toe, and as you know, I broke my toe.
Right.
In my office, right? And it's like one thing after another. It was one thing after another. And it was like, you know, breaking up, you know, my in-laws' workshop and everything. It was bad. It was just a lot of negative things happened. And yours truly is like sometimes must be the Forrest Gump of the paranormal, because I'm not putting two to two together. So one day I thought, when I came back from Michigan, you know, from the Michigan Paracon, I thought, you know what? This is kind of strange. Something kind of rang in my head. I said, you know, I'm going to check this out. So I took it and I cleansed it in a voodoo ritual that a friend of mine instructed me on. And it lessened. Things lessened. Things got a little bit better. But it still wasn't right. So I took it and I did a binding prayer on it, and I blessed it with holy water that came from we have a person on the fast track of being a saint here in Western New York, and I went to his shrine and I got holy water and I did this whole thing and it lessened it, but it was still wasn't right. And I asked Zaphis, I said, Johnny, I said, what do I do with this? I still want it in my collection. He said, leave it out in the sun, direct sunlight for a couple days, and you know, that should do it. And I tried that and it lessened it. And I sat there the other day, and I matter of fact, I just did a talk on objects, haunted objects last night, and I showed it to people, and I make sure nobody touches it, and it's in a case. And I said to him, this was my biggest mess up. And when I'm done, I'm going to talk one or two more times. This piece is going away. I'm going to either bury it, which is what you do with it, or I'm going to submerge it in water, and I live very close to Lake Erie. This was something that I should never have done. I should have known better. But I just did it, and it was an impulsive thing, and I wasn't thinking. So these are things that can happen. And it's not big things that usually goes on. I have a small teddy bear and a Bakelite mirror box, a real small thing. And it belonged to a 5-year-old girl. And this, you know, she passed. She had a terminal illness, sadly, and unfortunately she passed. And the parents began seeing the apparition of a child and hearing, you know, a little, you know, giggling and stuff in the night. And it freaked them. And it had to be removed. They looked at it. They had already broken up the child's room and given away to different organizations, the bedroom and the toys and such, but they kept these two little pieces. And it always seemed that the activity seemed to be around these two pieces. And it was sad, very, very sad. And it was suggested that it would be taken out of the house to see what happened. And sure enough, when it was removed from the house, it no longer was going on. And a lot of people would say, geez, you know, this was like a tangible connection to their daughter. But here's my question. Was it? Is it really the daughter? I mean, I don't know. I can touch it, and through, like, psychometry, I can feel a vibration off. I can feel this broken heart, this something missing in life. You know, you get that feel. And I will say that it probably, in my belief system, I believe it might have been. But it caused unrest in the parents' house, in their lives. And they were starting to go, the best way I can describe it is in the stages of possession, it becomes almost obsessive, oppressive. And they just felt that. So by relieving them of that, and of course, you know, talking to them and counseling them, you know, I have a friend who's a substance abuse and grief counselor. He, you know, I send a lot of these cases that we run into to him, and he actually sat down and counseled them on their grief and on guilt, and everything stopped. And they were very, very thankful to get the piece out of the house, even though that their love for their daughter is still very, very paramount. So these are things that, you know, they're negative. And then, of course, I mean, you've got stuff that's downright nasty. You get this cursed stuff that is like just brutal. We had a case on the Indian reservation, Cattaraugus Indian Reservation up here in New York State, where there was a lot of problems, and it was almost as if it was like an incubus attack on the woman. And when we started delving into it, we found out that they had relatives, and you know, in a lot of these areas, these certain locations, they will bring in ringers. They'll bring in sorcerers. They'll bring in people that aren't afraid to have to send negative stuff out, and they don't care if it comes back at them. They'll do it for a price or whatever. These people do exist. And when they started going and digging around the property, they started finding fetishes here and there. And, this was a curse. These people were cursed. And I remember talking to these people on the phone, and I heard banging and the kids screaming and crying and all sorts of electrical problems on the cell phone, you know, and all this hissing and crackling and stuff when stuff would go on. And I had a friend of mine who is with the Wisdom Keepers, and he's one of the elders locally, and he went out there and he removed the fetishes. And he said to me, he says, don't think of it anymore. He says, we'll take care of the situation, but it's not yours. This is something that we have to do. It was created by a Native American that he called a sender. He says, I will take care of this. I'll calm it down. He says, and now I will remove these pieces and I will take care of it and don't ask again. So, I mean, some pieces become cursed objects. And again, you know, people buy this stuff in markets. My late father-in-law spent time in Chad and Africa. He brought back all sorts of masks and brass pieces and stuff. Thankfully, he never brought any attachments or anything with him, but people don't realize that. You can do that. Sometimes these pieces are passed down. People are selling them, and tourists buy them and bring them home. I have a small piece that Jason Love from Edinburgh gave me. It's just a little effigy from New Zealand. And I talked to him about it, and he goes, Tim, this was made for the tourist trade. Yet it's cursed. Yet these people brought this stuff back, and they feel that something's going on in the house. He goes, I brought psychics in. I brought a medium in. They feel the same thing. We took this piece out, and it cleansed. It just became clear. Everything became lighter. So you don't know. You don't know what it is. And again, when you're working with these things, you don't want to destroy them, because if there is something, if there is a spirit essence, or perhaps even, and I always say, you know, that laser point focus, that intent within that vibratory field, you go and destroy this thing, you can open it up. And you can send it on its way, and it can cause havoc, almost like a non-human targeted poltergeist case. I mean, these are things that can happen. So you have to do different important things to it. And again, like I say, I'm going to probably bury this piece or put it in Lake Erie and the piece that I have. So people have to understand that this is nothing to fool with. 99.9% of the haunted objects that are out there. First of all, guys, don't buy haunted objects on eBay. You know, I know people that are always selling stuff on eBay saying that they're haunted.
Right.
But if you have something that you feel is legitimately haunted, you got to find somebody to take care of it and remove it out of your house. And that's what I do. I am not afraid of it. My spirituality and my faith in it comes from within. I'm a firm believer that most of the things that we do remove are from spirits that are in visitation. That means that they're willingly there for whatever reason. People are associating these visitations, these sightings, these sight smells, these encounters with a certain piece, and they want it out of the house. So we go in and we educate the people. We talk to the people. We cleanse the house. We cleanse the object. If they want to keep the object, that's no problem. I don't have a problem with that. If they want to get rid of it, I'll take it from Ouija boards. I mean, I've got like 17 Ouija boards. Most of them people give me because they've had negative experiences with it. Are they haunted? I don't think they're haunted. I think, again, you brought up a good topic, a good point. It's the people using them that may be affecting. Same thing with haunted objects. It may be just the people that are there. Why are people subjected to temporal possession attempts or attacks, poltergeist attacks, that aren't, let's say, kids? You know, you're getting that non-human target syndrome. Right person, right place at the right time. If the vibrations are right, you've got some kind of energy in the house, that focus can go and blossom. So, you know, and it's happening with a lot of paranormal investigators that I know. They're starting to get more and more attachments because they're bringing pieces out of quote-unquote haunted locations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, they find a nail and they bring it out of like a very, very negative location. And next thing I know, I'm getting a call saying, I was up at this local house by you and I brought, you know, I just found this nail and I put it in my pocket. That's all it takes. Sometimes these attachments will come with you. Sometimes it depends on the person. Again, I don't have a problem with it. You know, guys like Johnny Zaffis don't, I mean, because we're pretty much set in our own spirituality. But a lot of people, there's a chink in your armor, Dave, they will figure it out and they will exploit it. And they will make your life a living hell. Usually, I find that, like, with haunted objects, things go in cycles. And, you know, people laugh because the trunk that I keep all my Ouija boards in is right next to my guest bedroom. Or right to my guest bed. I have one on the wall, and every so often somebody will stay in the house and they'll go, hey, you know, there was something like, you got like mice in the wall, or did you have a squirrel in there? Because I heard some scratching and some running around, and I don't have the heart to say, well, it might be coming from that trunk, but I don't find it happens all the time. And right now I've got, I got a foot locker full of haunted objects that I'm taking with me to different locations to talk about. And I have no problem with them. Yet people, I believe a lot of it is, you know, people, so you believe, so it shall be. And I believe a lot of people put too much emphasis on it. And they actually, it's almost like going into a haunted location, and that location vibratorily knows what you are expecting. And it will do its best to produce it. Same thing with haunted objects. It's all vibrational. Everything is vibrational in nature. So I believe that, you know, these, you know, humans and on the other side, they can go and they can affect these things. And that's what makes them haunted.
What we're wrapping up here, Tim, and I always like to go out with a bang. You've seen so much. You've been so many places. Tell me your personal scariest story and experience that happened directly to you.
You know what? In all the years that I've done this stuff, there's only one time that I was ever driven out of a location, and that was up at Old Fort Niagara. And I used to be a volunteer up there, and I was a docent, and I was waiting for somebody to show up, at this group to show up. You know, they're going to do an overnight, and they never showed up. So I was in the. They call it the French Castle, and I loved it. And, you know, I've heard stuff in there, you know, and I've seen stuff in there. But it was that one night that, you know, it just didn't feel right. And we talk about that barometric pressure dipping, and it dipped, and it felt weird. And that's the best way I can hear it. And I heard footsteps, and everybody's hear footsteps. And I heard this big bang from the second floor, and I went up there, and I'm by myself, and I got a flashlight, and I'm checking around. I don't see anything. I hear some more footsteps. I'm up on the third floor checking around. I'm checking every single room. Nothing's going on. And I settle down, you know, and I'm not going to go and wake anybody up that, you know, like the executive director or anything. I'm going to wait it out. You know, I'm going to sit there and I've got a fire going in the little kitchen area. And it was great. You know, I'm just relaxing. And I hear this bang, 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 like footsteps going back and forth. And that barometric pressure just dipped. I started getting goosebumps. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. And I just yelled out. And again, I'm one of these people that when it comes to spirit, I go and I talk. I yell it out because I think my voice vibration is what is, you know, it's the quickest way out there. I don't do that Svengali thing with the head, you know. I don't do that. I want them to know I'm there. So I yelled right up there, well, you know, will you cut it out already? Of course, I use a couple swear words in there. And it got oppressive. It got oppressive. And I started hearing footsteps, and there's this two sets of stairways coming down from the second floor. And it had a ring to it. And reenactors know, and people who are interpreters know, that these old shoes used to have horseshoes on them to keep the heels well. And I could hear the metal hitting the steps. Bang, bang, bang. By the time it hit the fourth step, I'm going to tell you, Dave, it's the only time that it just, I got this, the exorcists call it the gift of discernment. You get that queasiness right in your solar plexus. I got that. I stood up. The hair on my arm stood up, and I had to go. I left. And I got all the way out, and there's the ADT alarm to shut everything down, you know, make sure everything could lock it up, and I didn't have the new code. So I went, and I said, I'm not going to go. I can't leave. I just took my little truck, parked it in front of it, and I went to sleep underneath a blanket in a fetal position, and I'm man enough to say that that was the only time that I ever got freaked out, and it was because it just felt so bad. And I mean, I was up there looking, everything's locked down, there is nobody in this building, I'm checking underneath beds in this place, I'm all over. If there was somebody in there, they were the master hide and seek champ, because I couldn't find them. And I mean, I was there for quite a few years, and that was the only time. And you know, Dave, I laugh about it to this day, but I'm glad I left, because whatever was there, I just felt that it had something to do with it. There was a purpose to it. And by me leaving, it was able to go and complete its purpose. And I've never had a problem with it since. And I've stayed in there since then. So that's my only time.
That is awesome.
I should be ashamed, but I'm not.
No, we all have those holy shit moments. Tim Shaw, thank you so much for joining us and spending some time. It's always a pleasure catching up with you. And I hope we can do it again real soon.
Thank you. It's been an honor. And again, I love you guys, and blessings to everybody out there listening. And seriously, this is probably one of the best shows out there. It's an inspiration to me, and it should be to everybody else.
Thank you. You're too kind. And thank you all for tuning in and being a part of our world. Remember, you can hear me tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Check for local listings and times in your area by visiting coasttocoastam.com/stations. Or you can listen to me tomorrow. I'm on both nights on Coast to Coast AM from midnight till 4 a.m. And we've got a lot of cool things to cover. You can keep up with George Nori and the rest of the Coast to Coast AM crew and continue to hear the best in overnight talk radio 7 days a week. And remember, you can listen to it right from knsiradio.com, my home, my broadcasting home for Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back again next week. Remember to go check out podcastone.com. Click on the Killer Deals link, find the Beyond the Darkness banner, click that, and make sure you go check out our Amazon page and all of the cool items that we've hand-selected for that page. Ghost hunting tools, books, DVDs, all the cool stuff right there. And every time you make a purchase from that page, a small portion goes to help support your buddies on the show and keep all of our administrative costs down, our ads at a minimum. So that's what you can do to help support us. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. This is Beyond the Darkness.